This is the Real Estate Guru 254 podcast, and we are just coming up on episode number 8. Hamjambo wasikilizaji, karibuni kwa mtandao wetu. Glad to have you here with us. My name is David Mbatia, and today I'm winging it on my own. There's nobody here with me, but I'm sure it's going to be a breeze. It's always good to have you guys back here listening in. And today, again, I hope that you guys get to learn something new, build some new perspectives on the real estate industry in Kenya. Today, I'm going to be discussing the metrics around pricing property for sale in a buyer's market. First of all, maybe a brief description of a buyer's market is where you have a lot of sellers and very few buyers. That situation, for example, in the real estate market in Kenya has persisted for a while. And this conversation is going to come off an interesting scenario that was raised by a prospective client who essentially just wanted to understand what she needed to do to generate interest in her property offer. She felt that she was not gaining any traction, primarily due to her pricing decisions, especially because she felt that her property was undervalued. Okay, so she approached us also on the recommendation of a client who we had previously assisted to acquire a unit in the same development where she was selling, and we had helped this client in the year 2020. So this is the way she posed her question to us.
I own an apartment which I acquired for 5 million shillings in 2017. While I live in the apartment, in 2020, I took the decision to sell this property. However, 2 years later, I have still yet to sell it. When I contracted a property valuer, he gave me a valuation of just 6.5 million shillings, while the proposed sales values touted for my apartment by the property agents I approached averaged at just 5.5 million shillings. I felt very discouraged to sell, as I would much prefer really only to sell if I could command a price of 7 million or more, based on the fact that I had paid 5 million for it in 2017, and especially given the closing costs, which may average as much as 5% to 7% of the disposal value, and also because I have an outstanding debt on my mortgage to clear. About 1 year into the process of attempting to sell the property, and after the property agents failed to raise any leads at the price of 7 million, I requested that they market the property at a reduced selling price of 6.5 million shillings, which was actually the valuation I had been given by the valuer I had hired. And also, since one of the agents I had recruited for the purpose of selling my unit showed me currently listed offers that ranged only between 5.3 million and 6 million shillings, I have still been unable to generate any serious interest, even though the price I am asking for is based on the actual valuation of the property. Now, given this scenario, what would you advise? So in order to really assist Gladys, the first thing I think we need to do is have situational awareness of the scenario that Gladys presents. That's the first thing we're going to do. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to attempt to define the conditions in a buyer's market, just so that we have a context in order to give her a clear response. I think responding outside of the context of understanding the buyer's market will not be beneficial to her. After we have done this, we have a situational awareness and we understand the conditions in a buyer's market, the next thing we'll go proceed to do is actually offer advice. Gladys presents the problem as a pricing problem. However, with a clearer understanding of what a buyer's market looks like, we may have a different approach in answering or arriving at a solution for her. So maybe the next thing we will do is really take the time to understand the market. What are the distinctions for her particular property offer that make it unique? Who are the prospective buyers that she should be targeting? What are the market dynamics affecting price and perception of value? We also need to look at several market principles. One of them will be the principle of willing buyer, willing seller. The other principle that we will look at is the principle of fair market value compared to or vis-a-vis valuations. And then, of course, we will arrive at a conclusion. So We're going to go through these steps one by one in order for us to really be able to help Gladys and find a way to assist her. With a clear situational assessment of the scenario that Gladys has presented, we may be in a position to provide a robust as possible response. First, I think it's important to state that while the question Gladys poses is fundamentally about price, it makes at least one fatal assumption that the only reason she may be drawing blanks in the market is solely about price. I have to say, it is rarely ever about one thing, and while we will obviously be speaking to price, we will naturally speak about the many other factors that are perhaps just as important. She mentions that she actually put in the effort to sell, she contracted a property valuer, and she also contracted several property agents. These were obviously good first steps to take. The valuer can give her a relatively true estimate of the property's value, while property agents can, on the other hand, give her a true estimate of the property's fair market value on the open market. The agents can also assist her, obviously, to generate leads and eventually dispose of the property. She also mentions that she was discouraged at both the valuation and pricing recommendation by the agents that she spoke to, given the feedback that they offered and also given what was presented to her about currently listed market offers within the same development for similar units. So we can say that Gladys has been aggressive about actually selling the property. This is demonstrated by her efforts to have the property one valued, and of course her efforts to recruit agents to sell the property. She also appears to have some awareness of the market, even if that awareness may be a bit limited. So to provide some context to the scenario that Gladys presents, let us consider the following. One, her asking price was 7 million shillings. Two, her property valuation is only 6.5 million shillings. Three, she dropped her asking price to 6.5 million when she failed to generate any leads after 1 year of being in the market. Four, the average or fair market price for her offer is currently at 5.5 million with an average price variance of 700,000, which is little over 10%. Now, how did we arrive at the price variance of 700,000? Remember, she mentioned that the lowest offer for a similar unit was 5.3 million and the highest offer was 6 million. And this information she was provided by an agent. The variance is the difference between the highest price point, which is 6 million, and the lowest, which was 5.3, and that is a difference of 700,000. Five, Gladys has debt, but there is no disclosure at the level of distress she may be experiencing, if any, owing to that debt. Still, we could make the assumption that her decision to sell is in part motivated by some degree of discomfort that she may be experiencing. We can also tell, given that her expectation is far outside of the property's valuation, that she's quintessentially what in the property market we call a sentimental seller. What we mean by that is she's making an attempt to assign value to a property that is of a sentimental nature. And this is most likely attributable to the fact that she is an owner-occupier of the said property. So on the analysis of this information, especially given that there is both a high price variance, anything really between plus or minus 10% is very high, and significantly lower listing prices, her asking is now 6.5, but the highest price point already that she has for a similarly listed offer is 6 million, with the lower ones at 5.3 million. Of course, when compared to valuation, that price point is low. It is also clear that Gladys is attempting to sell in a depressed market. She talks about the agents being unable to generate leads, and this may be typically because, one, of course, her price point was high, but secondly, even at that price point, you generally also see a few leads coming in. This type of market, as I mentioned before, is typically called a buyer's market, but it's also referred to in other terms, typically a down cycle market, a soft market, or even a depressed market. Given this information, and now that we are more aware of the prevailing market conditions, we can at least now attempt to define the conditions in a buyer's market, and then subsequently perhaps help Gladys understand how these market conditions and other market variables, which also subsist in the market today, work and how they work before we can actually provide her with some insights or advice. We are now situationally aware of Gladys's problem. So the second thing we're going to do now is to attempt to define the conditions in a buyer's market. So for the benefit of the uninitiated, a buyer's market is basically a condition that, or a period that subsists in the market where supply far outstrips demand, with the consequential effect that it significantly drives down prices. During the pandemic, when many people either lost their incomes or saw their businesses completely disrupted, many of them opted to get out of what we call leveraged positions. So business debt, mortgages, that sort of thing. With the goal, of course, of converting idle or dead capital into working capital. Particularly those who had no way to make a repayment on their loans, those who are not in a position to use their real estate properties to generate an income. That was primarily the person who was trying to get out of debt. So the consequence of that was that, you know, sellers flooded the market, and naturally, because of diminished incomes, many buyers also shied away from the market. So markets, and the real estate market specifically, invariably follows trends depending on the flows or cycles of supply and demand. These flows are affected by both micro and macroeconomic factors. But, you know, today, that's not the lesson we're going to go through. This is not a class in economics. If you are selling, what is fundamentally important for you to understand is that the market cycle you are in is important for you to understand so that you can make informed decisions. One of those decisions, of course, is pricing decisions, and that pricing decision will be very dependent on the specific goal that you have. So at the point that we are recording this, we are still experiencing a down cycle in most property categories, and that is exacerbated by the prevailing economic conditions. We have low liquidity in the market, poor cash flows in the consumer segment of the market due to, again, disruptions in income, an unsettled economy due to rising costs of living. We are glad that we are past the uncertainty of an election cycle, but we are still mired in an economic debt crisis. And we have basically what you call a looming recession. You know, there's a likelihood also of increased interest rates because the central bank recently raised the CBR rate. You know, all this translates into increased costs of doing business. So that market uncertainty is still a reality even today. For those of you, again, who favor market statistics, you will note that the mortgage account numbers fell for a second consecutive year in 2021 from 27,993 mortgages in 2019 to close at just 26,723 mortgages at the close of 2021. This represented a drop of nearly 5%. Again, in Kenya, the mortgage market is not that robust. However, it's a good indicator. When you see a 5% drop in the number of mortgage accounts, that should clearly give an indication of the austerity that may be there within the economy. So, what would be an ideal price point to attract prospects to your offer under these conditions? One of the questions that comes up again, should you offer the market price incentives just because of the prevailing market conditions? And maybe to just answer the first question, which is, what is the ideal price point to you to attract prospects to your offer? So I would say that an ideal price needs to be based on your specific objective. If you intend to make a quick exit, it would be ideal that you price between what we call the bottom of the market and the market value of your property. Prospects will be bargain hunting, and you will want them to at least look twice in your direction. So the bottom of the market for Gladys is 5.3 million, and the valuation that she has for her property is 6.5 million. So if you do an average between 5.3 million and 6.5 million, I believe that approaches 5.9 million, if I'm not wrong. That would be the price point that you go in, because essentially what you want to do is just attract market offers. You will notice that she's at least 100,000 below at the highest price point. And in that way, if nothing else, at least she can attract attention to her offer. On the other hand, if you really don't care about when you sell, in other words, you're not distressed for any reason, then you can price between the top and the middle of the market. This will allow you to get a better deal than a distressed seller, since genuine prospects will still haggle but may not go far below the top of the market. So in the scenario that Gladys presents, top of the market is her price, which is her valuation at 6.5, and the highest listed offer is at 6 million. If you add the two and you get an average, then the average price that she would be offering at that price at that point would be about 6.25 million shillings. Yeah, these become things you're going to consider if you are going to price well outside the top of the market. For example, what Gladys initially did, which was to price at 7 million, then you really had better know who your prospects are and the specific places where to find them. With absolute certainty, you must be giving far greater value than any other competing seller. And that value is exactly what the prospects you are targeting are looking for. If not, expect to be holding on to your property for yet a while longer. To answer the second question, which is about incentivizing the market through massive discounts, I believe that is always a double-edged strategy that can either work for a seller or work against them. If you give too much, your offer may be considered inferior. Again, if you give too little, you may end up being in the market for a while longer. In a buyer's market, competing purely on price, in my view, is a losing strategy that will eventually over time erode value for all the sellers in the market. It is unlikely that sellers would attempt to coalesce on strategy, since they are independent and the market tends to correct the imbalances between demand and supply naturally. However, in a common market, this would be a brilliant way of protecting sellers from predatory investors who would only be keen on driving the hardest bargains possible. This, you know, being able to coalesce together would also weed out what we call tire kickers, prospects who actually eventually never buy. So one more thing to note: in buyer market conditions, your pricing and how flexible and open you are to negotiate may eventually determine whether you inevitably lose either time or money, or eventually both. For a distressed seller in harsh economic times, the time value for money becomes far much more important than the absolute value of money. So here you're talking about moving with agility, speed, and responsiveness. Determine how fast you can close by moving with agility, speed again, and I say, and responsiveness. Many sellers, especially owner-occupiers of property, tend to be what we call sentimentally attached to the property they are selling. They assign value to the property that no buyer can see, or for that matter, would be willing to pay for. If you are a distressed seller, this is perhaps one of the gravest mistakes you can make, especially in buyer market conditions. It is unwise to pick an argument with the wisdom of the market, in my view, about what is fair value, since the laws of demand and supply operate in open markets. It is actually precisely these laws that make the market, you know, what we call self-deterministic, meaning that price levels can sway depending on market sentiment and not necessarily driven by either the demand side or the supply side of the market. So at this juncture, we have a very clear understanding of Gladys's situation. We have a clearer understanding of what a buyer's market is and the conditions that are prevailing there. But before we really go into offering any real advice as to the tangible things or the real things that Gladys can do to actually help sell her property faster, we still need to understand a few more things about the market. And at this point, what we're going to look at is one, location. We're also going to try and understand who our potential buyer may be. And we're also going to make an effort to understand other market dynamics that affect price and the perception of value. And then, of course, the last thing I think we will look at a little bit later before we go into offering Gladys any sort of meaningful advice would be to consider some principles in the marketplace. So we're going to look at the principle of willing buyer, willing seller, which is very commonly stated in our market, wherever real estate transactions are occurring. And then we will also talk about a little bit about what fair market value actually is. So let's dig into the first one, which is location. What makes your property truly stand out? Fundamentally, there's a very popular maxim in real estate. We say that people don't buy homes, they buy the neighborhood. And what that generally means is that location is fundamentally very key in understanding who our potential buyers would be. So one of the gravest mistakes that many sellers make is they fail to recognize the market with which they are attempting to engage. In part, it could be that they are either misinformed, perhaps a little bit hyped up by, you know, the many agents who project the confidence of meeting the seller's expectations. And that would be understandable why they would do this, because of course they're looking for a commission on the sale. In part, many sellers are also just driven by market bravado, built upon, you know, unrealistic expectations around the common narratives that people have on real estate. For example, there is a common misconception that capital gains are always assured or guaranteed on real estate investments. This is a commonly accepted narrative because our market is fundamentally driven by speculation, so much so that even in markets where newer, more superior offers are emerging at lower prices, because of the adoption of cheaper construction technologies and methods, many investors who go in early into a particular market or midterm perceive their capital growth to be assured or to be higher than that that would be achieved in the newer investments, when in reality this isn't true. And especially this isn't true within what we call multi-dweller settlements. Is it universally true that capital gains are guaranteed on every real estate transaction? I don't think so. And maybe to illustrate this point, we could use the example of two separate developments, and we're going to look at units in a low density development as compared to units in high density developments within the same neighborhood. And we want to consider why units in high density developments tend to attract higher prices. And that is fundamentally because there are fewer units per capita of land. So imagine a scenario where two sellers in two adjacent developments, one a low density development and the other high density, both constructed on an equal or similar mass of land in the same neighborhood, each selling a unit of comparatively similar size, and both having been acquired or developed around the same time, with only key distinction being that one is a high density development while the other is a low density development. So naturally, the seller in the high density development would have acquired his unit at a much lower price simply because there are more units available, right? Even if it may have been the same size as the one in the low density development, and especially if it was constructed using new, cheaper construction technologies. This is fundamentally an element driven by the cost of land. Okay, let's complicate things a little further. Let's say that the unit in the high density development comes with, you know, far better local amenities. So that would perhaps include features like a swimming pool, commercial areas, that's shops and that kind of thing, restaurants, you know, business centers. It would come with solar water heating, green technologies for wastewater or waste management generally, backup solutions for water and electricity, lower cost for the provision of common services, and so on. All of which the lower density development does not feature. So these features are available, in the high density development, but they are not available in the low density development. Let's also say, for argument's sake, that the high density development is newer, or at least appears to have a more modern look and feel, because of its numbers, you know, can afford to charge lower rates for common services. You know, this is service charges. So naturally, the seller disposing of the unit in the low density development would be expecting, having been in the neighborhood for longer, that he would achieve a higher rate of capital growth, and that therefore his offer would be more attractive. However, who is he prospecting? A buyer would consider the additional value in the high density development to be very attractive, just given the extra number of features that they can enjoy by considering that proposition, right? In addition to a lower entry point, this is a lower purchase price, the recurring cost in the high density development would also be lower. In other words, there's a perception of value that may be significantly higher in the higher density development. The seller in the high density development can even opt to sell at a comparatively higher price than that being offered in the lower density development, simply because they can command that price based on the attractiveness of the neighborhood. That is not to say that the unit in the lower density development will not have a good perception of value. If you look at who your prospect is, there is possibly a buyer who is willing to make the compromise and, you know, accept lower standards in the lower density development because they prefer perhaps higher levels of privacy and possibly a greater amount of space. So here the distinctions between the two really is that in the low density development, you have more space, you have more functional space, especially if there is no crowding, you know. So there are points of attraction that, of course, naturally that the lower density development would have, right? Now, let's again look at who our prospective buyer is. What can a seller do to gain insight into the market? Now, first attempt to gain insight into who your prospective client is. In this case, if I were Gladys, you know, I would attempt to study the demographics of the residents who reside in the development where I am attempting to sell. And there are some basic questions that Gladys will want to answer as she's really considering who her prospective buyer is. What are the predominant characteristics of homeowners in that development? What would prospective buyers in that market be willing to pay slightly more for? Are they young families? Are they predominantly renters or owner-occupiers of the apartments in the development? If they are renting, what are the current rents? And can we comfortably project what their household income levels are? What gives the neighborhood its attractiveness? Is it the schools in the neighborhood? Is it the public, the amenities like shopping malls, that kind of thing? Can we construct or can we build a picture, an avatar of who our most likely prospects will be and how best we can engage with them to our advantage? These are questions that Gladys may want to answer going forward. Then let's again attempt to understand the market and specifically other dynamics that may be affecting price and perception of value. I'd say to Gladys, attempt to gain an understanding of the dynamics of the market. And here, the scenario we underscored between the high density and low density developments earlier is a good example. But there are other factors, external and internal to the development, that may drive price and which may ultimately either erode prospective capital gains or, for that matter, precipitate faster growth in different developments. Without, you know, a well-developed understanding of these dynamics, sellers may end up with skewed expectations, you know, when they go to market. apartment prices, especially in the secondary market, are usually demand driven, and demand patterns, especially in buyers markets, are heavily driven by price. So the other major factors may include infrastructure around the neighborhood being one of the most primary ones. You know, for the neighborhood, besides the available amenities, it would also be ideal to consider developments that are adjacent to each other. For example, if you went to a neighborhood, and I'll give the typical example that I have used several times, a neighborhood like you're attempting to sell an apartment, say in Syokimau, you should have a general overview of comparable developments in the neighborhoods that immediately surround Syokimau. So for example, those neighborhoods may include a neighborhood like Mlolongo, may include a neighborhood like Katani, may include a neighborhood like Utawala, all the way up to Athi River and even Lukenya. So you want to understand, are there comparable developments in those other neighborhoods, and what does pricing look like? And are there then comparative advantages for Syokimau as opposed to those other neighborhoods? So lastly, attempt to understand, you know, the general principles that guide market interactions between buyers and sellers. And here we're going to consider a few. One of them is the willing buyer, willing seller maxim. So there's a maxim in our market that goes, talks about willing buyer, willing seller. And what does this mean? I'm not going to go into the technical definition because it's a whole mouthful, but let's just try and break it down in this way. What it means essentially is that the buyer is neither over eager nor determined to buy at any price, and a willing seller is neither an over eager nor a forced seller prepared to sell at any price, nor one prepared to hold out for a price that is not considered reasonable in the current market. What this means is that both parties can engage with each other to arrive at a price determined in large part by their willingness to either concede, compromise, and even agree on what is reasonable and fair to both of them. The price isn't carried on a label or fixed, but you know, can be considered fair by both parties. That brings us then to the question of what is fair market value. Now, fair market value is really the price at which the property could potentially change hands between a willing buyer and a willing seller, neither being under any compulsion to buy or to sell, and both having reasonable knowledge of relevant facts regarding the market. So relevant facts, again, like I said, refers to knowledge of the market. So one, fair market value is never, hardly ever the same as market value or appraised value. Appraised value is what you get from the valuer that you hired. In this case, the valuer that Gladys hired would have told her what the appraised value is. And that may be significantly different, as we can observe from this example. It may be significantly different from what is called fair market value. In a buyer's market, you have eager sellers, but the power vests with the buyers. Remember, that's why it's called a buyer's market, since the buyers know that they are literally golden. Very few of them exist in that market. So the natural presumption of this principle is that both parties are fairly well informed. On the one hand, the seller is well informed of the value of what he or she is selling, and on the other hand, the buyer is fairly well informed about the available offers in the market, and that therefore the two of them can arrive at what can be considered a fair or viable price. Yeah, obviously there's no single or unified source of information that provides data including any number of, you know, the possible available offers at any particular time within any particular jurisdiction or neighborhood, or any number of possible variations in the quality of offers available, so that these can be compared against each other for the sake of determining, you know, where is the best value, and therefore which offers may attract, you know, higher or lower prices. In other words, there is nothing like perfect information about the marketplace. Now, having said that, however, as a seller, you should reasonably expect that prospective buyers will find the market can and will make the effort to establish an ideal or fair price point by finding comparable offers in the marketplace. And in addition, that they will, acting in their own best interest, seek to drive down the price. So remember the old wise saying, which goes, you know, this way: price is what you pay, value is what you receive, right? So value is more subjective than price and can be assessed by one individual in one way, but in a completely different way by another individual. If you hire two valuers, for example, to assess the same property, and they didn't have any market comparables, in other words, they did not have information about other offers in the market, for them to make a fair assessment, they would more than likely give you two different values. But how can it be that two valuers can look at the same item and value it in two different ways? Well, the process tends to be subjective, and based on their best knowledge or information about the market, they will make a judgment based on that. But if you recall, we said there isn't perfect information in the marketplace, right? So a valuation should therefore merely be a guide. So when Gladys was told that her property is worth 6.5 million, but she could see in the market that the offers were ranging between 5.3 million and 6 million, she should have understood that the valuation which was given of 6.5 million was merely a guide. An even better guide would be comparable property offers. In other words, what are people willing to pay? And this goes back again to the principle of willing buyer, willing seller. In the interest of time, because this episode has overrun, we're going to conclude this particular episode of the podcast here. But we would strongly encourage you, anyone who's listening, to catch episode 9, which will be included as part 2 of this interesting conversation. And in that conversation is where we're going to conclude with the advice that we would actually give Gladys in order to help her actually sell her property. That advice is general advice, which basically would also come as advice to anybody in the market trying to sell their property and really trying to find a way to connect with buyers. Again, we hope you learned something new today. Send us your questions, comments, and feedback. Any feedback that you may have, include any topics of interest you may want to have featured here. We'd be glad if you share this podcast with your friends, rate it, and leave us a review wherever you come across it, and subscribe to get notified of upcoming episodes. This goes a long way to supporting our work. Connect with us on social media. Our social media handles included in the description of this podcast. Do you have a story in the real estate space that can inspire, inform, and educate? To feature as a guest, please fill out a podcast guest form and tell us a little bit about yourself and the topics you would like to discuss. We would love to hear from you. So email us, send us a WhatsApp message, and we shall pick up the conversation with you. Lastly, you can support this production financially by contacting our marketing team to advertise on the podcast, or through your generous giving by using the links in the description of this podcast. Thank you so much for your love and support. We totally appreciate it. Catch you on the next episode, guys.